This is Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
It's 4 minutes after seven. Welcome to it. You're listening to Classic Business Breakfast with myself, Nastasia Aronsa. It is day four and Arabile is still not wearing his Man United top. I am getting very worried here.
Hey, we're in international break now. So, you know, we're going to have to support the international teams now. So I don't necessarily have one of those international jerseys yet. Just a hint, hint.
We can get you one.
Get me one. There we go. Okay. There we go. Then I'll wear it.
All right. Anyway, we're going to be talking about Standard Bank. That's because the future of more than 500 Standard Bank employees hangs in the balance as the country's biggest bank by assets is looking to revamp its IT division. So we'll speak to Eugene Eberson, who is from SASPO, the finance union, about it.
And also then the economic impact of the presidential investment pledges. Yesterday we spoke about whether the new changes or the investment pledges themselves will be able to help the poor. Let's talk about the economic impact then of these and what exactly will change when it comes to South Africa's economy. Will it add? Will it detract? How much more investment can we get? Because clearly one brings two, and the consequences here are quite heavy, as you can tell, with more investment coming into South Africa.
And Eskom's coal stockpile situation has deteriorated further, with five power stations having less than 10 days stock. Interventions to stabilize the coal supply may only have a positive impact by March next year. So we'll speak to Antoinette Slabbert, who's a journalist at MoneyWeb, and she's been covering Eskom for quite some time, so she'll give us some perspective as to what's happening there.
And today, Cappuccino with the CEO is with Ahmed Mohammed. He was voted and named the Business Person of the Year at the Marina Chamber of Commerce Business Awards Gala dinner, and we get to chat to him. He's the CEO of Datacentrix. And we'll unpack exactly how he got to where he is, a long-standing career with Datacentrix, and we'll just talk to him about his leadership and his thoughts just on the industry. All that and more coming up before 8 o'clock. Let's get into your Thursday edition of Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
This is Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
Quick check-in on the market. Stocks in Asia mixed in the morning, despite an apparent improvement in market risk sentiment after British Prime Minister Theresa May said she had obtained enough support for her proposed Brexit deal to move forward. The Hang Seng Index rose 0.6%. Mainland China markets, which have been closely watched as a result of Beijing's ongoing trade spat with Washington, saw gains as well. The Shanghai Composite advancing nearly 1%. The Shenzhen Composite gained 0.7%, but Japan's Nikkei slipped 0.25%. In morning trade. In overnight market action on Wall Street, the S&P 500 slipped around 0.7% to close at 2,701 points, while the Dow Jones declined by 205 points rather, to finish the day trading just over 25,000 points. The Nasdaq Composite also saw declines of 0.9%, while in Europe, the FTSE 100 added 0.5%, the French CAC 0.3%, and the German DAX 0.5%. And the All Share lost 0.2% to 51,999 points, and the top 40 dropping marginally over there.
This is Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
Independent analyst Chris Gilmore joining us this morning as we chat everything markets. Chris, the negative train seems to be just flowing everywhere else. Look, the Republicans may not have won the midterms, but they seem to be winning the markets, if you can call it that. Red everywhere.
Yeah. And, you know, more and more commentators in the U.S. particularly are talking about the specter of recession hitting the U.S. at some point in time, maybe in 2020, maybe even a little bit earlier. Look, I don't necessarily subscribe to that view, but I do take the point that this is one of the longest-lasting recoveries we've ever seen in the U.S. Started in March 2009. And at some point in time, it's going to have to turn. Mm. And if you scrape under the surface, it's a very strange recovery you've got. Yes, some of the results we've had from the U.S. companies, some certain U.S. companies, have actually been quite good. But interestingly enough, and I think I've mentioned this before, a lot of the money that's been that companies have received because of the lower tax rates that the Trump administration has conferred upon them is not going back into infrastructure in those companies. It's being used for immediate consumption, things like share buybacks. And the like. And that, of course, is fueling the market. So we're not really getting a huge amount of confidence in the U.S. economy. I think there's a lot of smoke and mirrors, frankly. So to come back to the point, I think, yes, I think there's likely to be a bit of a downturn by 2020. And, of course, this raises the issue of should the U.S. Federal Reserve be increasing rates at the rate at which they are. We're going to get probably another one in December, 25 basis points, and then maybe three or four next year. And then after that, are we going to go into a downturn? Are we going to go into a recession? If so, that's going to make things an awful lot worse. And you can see why the tension between Trump and Reserve Bank Chairman Jerome Powell is what it is.
Yeah. If we bring things a bit, bring things back locally, Discovery launching that bank, certainly not, it's not active yet, and it'll only be active in March 2019, but the official launch, which perhaps was a little preemptive of what may indeed come forward, it sounds good, but is it too good to be true?
No. Look, my experience with Discovery is it's never too good to be true. You're never, ever, ever disappointed with Discovery. The only time we were slightly disappointed, and this was because of events way beyond their control, was when they went with Destiny Health into the US.
Yes.
And, you know, the Americans don't like anyone beating them at their own tricks, and they kind of forced them out. So, you know, the innovation is absolutely exquisite. And they've really taken their time on this one. You know, we were supposed to be seeing this by the middle of this year, in fact. So it's going to be about 9 months late. So what? You know, we're talking about something that's going to be hugely disruptive. You know, to start with, obviously, we're not talking about anything particularly fancy. But in their inimitable fashion, I think it's going to be, as I said before, it's going to be very innovative. They're going to use Vitality as the enabler for everything, as they've done with all of their products. And I suspect, you know, it's going to end up being an incredibly sought after product by so many people across the socioeconomic spectrum.
Yeah, initially this is aimed at the higher spectrum of the market, and he's called it a behavioral bank. It is, as he said, it's supposed to be launched at the mass affluent segment, but expects it to appeal to all segments. But now it seems that, you know, we have new banks that are essentially catering for so many different kinds and levels of people. Time Bank, of course, a digital bank controlled by billionaire Patrice Motsepe, set to target mainly unbanked and the underserved clients and small and medium enterprises. Bank Zero, of course, coming on board, which is chaired by former FNB CEO Michael Jordan, and that is set to target business customers. It's complete disruption across the board here in the banking sector.
Oh, no, totally. And yesterday I went to the results presentation of a small company called Capital Appreciation. You know, Bradley Sachs and his father, Motti Sachs, and they're doing an incredibly good job. I mean, this thing is really moving very, very nicely. Again, a disruptive thing, but not disruptive in any kind of negative way at all. I mean, at this point in time, they're actually partnering with the banks. They're saying to them, you know, here's how we can help you guys.
Sure.
I think the problem is the big traditional banks are struggling now because they've got these legacy systems that they can't really change overnight.
Yeah.
And they really can do very little about them. And it's an incredibly expensive exercise. And this is why I think you see with Standard now talking about retrenching, 500 people in their IT department.
Yeah,
so
that's certainly going to hurt them as well. And do you think that's a systemic problem? Do you think that's something that's going to perhaps come about in some of the other banks as well, that the sense of retrenchment?
I think it's undoubtedly going to happen. I don't see how they can avoid it. I mean, there are so many new startups, disruptive forces in the sector, some of which, you know, work with the banks. But at the end of the day, the banks, I think, are their own worst enemy. They've never really been able to understand many aspects of the market. be it at the low end, be it at the top end. I mean, for example, if you have a private bank, that private bank account of yours really should be able to do just about everything for you. And yet there are only maybe one or two players in the market, I won't name names, who really do it properly. At the low end of the market, you know, you've got Capitec and you've got one or two others. But some of the ones you've mentioned there are going to add to that that interesting combination.
Yeah.
So I think that's good. We're looking at a huge shakeup. And the only thing that the big traditional banks can control is their costs.
Do you think that those go down far enough? Do you believe that those can go down far enough? I mean, the lower they go, that begins to hurt profits and bottom lines, and that becomes a big issue. Do you think they'll look at it and say, yeah, we are down, you know, dropping prices? Or will they just be forced to anyway because of circumstance?
Well, there's two things. They can drop prices and they can cut costs. But what they can also do, and this is where I think there may be a misunderstanding. You know, if you look at these smaller players, at the end of the day, they're very consumer-centric.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to go in there and wait for 3 or 4 days to open an account. Mm. It's going to happen literally within minutes. And if you look at the kind of things that Michael Jordan is tweeting about, it's absolutely fascinating what he's talking about, what Bank Zero is going to be doing.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's that customer centricity that I think the big banks have to try and get back to.
Yeah.
And it's difficult in large bureaucratic organizations where... you know, that's not necessarily the main thrust of the raison d'etre.
It's weird, though, that Standard Bank is doing this, particularly to their IT department, which is supposed to perhaps help them in trying to innovate and trying to perhaps keep up with the banks coming up now. But let's unpack a little bit more about that right now.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
15 minutes after 7, the future of more than 500 Standard Bank employees hangs in the balance as the country's biggest bank by assets is looking to revamp its IT division. The bank said it had concluded an IT review and showed it needed to adapt its operating model and skill set. And to talk to us about it is Eugene Eberson, who's the Assistant General Secretary at SUSPO, the finance union. Eugene, thank you so much for your time this morning. What are your thoughts on the restructuring plans at Standard Bank?
I think with an environment like South Africa where there's so much unemployment, I think it's quite sad. Although these people that are affected are highly skilled employees, and there's a possibility that they might elect to leave the bank on their own accord on a voluntary basis, it's still jobs that are being destroyed, and that's a pity for the whole economic environment. Just to give you a little bit of background regarding the 500 positions, or 528, it's not 528 positions in total that will be lost. Some positions are going to be decreased, and some additional positions are going to be created. So the 528 people can apply for approximately 349 positions that will be available. So in total, there's going to be 179 positions that will be surplus to the bank. And that's unfortunately the reality that you sit with.
How long have you been, in contact with the bank and having these discussions?
We had a special meeting last week, Friday. Staff were told in group sessions on Monday, and then Tuesday, Wednesday, individual consultations took place. The bank has to consider those, and SASBOS requested a follow-up meeting with the bank on Monday next week to finalize certain issues about timelines and employees' rights during the redeployment period. So the redeployment period is going to continue until the end of March next year. But employees have got an option of electing an incentivized voluntary retrenchment before that, and we need to clarify certain acts around those options.
They've done this before, I think in 2013, where they mentioned that they were looking to reduce their internal IT support. So are you worried this time around, or are you assuming that perhaps they might even handle this better?
We're hopeful that the bank will handle it better. Look, we said to the bank during the consultation, we cannot think of anything that's more demeaning than being a loyal employee for a number of years, being highly skilled, and then becoming redundant and unemployed. And the bank agreed with that. But unfortunately, you know, the working environment is changing. I don't know to what extent artificial intelligence and digitization has an impact on what's happening currently in the bank, but we know that the world of work has changed and we need to be prepared for that. So there were certain suggestions that SASB made with regards to additional training opportunities, entrepreneurship, incentivized voluntary retrenchments with additional funding available, and the bank was quite amenable to those suggestions. But it's still terrible. The jobs are lost, and they will be lost forever. But we are hopeful that the outcome will not be as bitter as what it was maybe 5 or 10 years ago.
Eugene, just before I let you go, there was a story about a month ago where Liberty was about to do the exact same thing, and there was even talks that Stanlib might even embark in the same direction. Are you involved in those discussions as well?
We've got a limited number of members in Liberty. We haven't got members, as far as I'm aware, in Stanlib. So no, I wouldn't be able to comment any further around any initiatives on that side.
No problem, Eugene. Thank you so much for your time. That's Eugene Ebbeson, who's the Assistant General Secretary at SASBO, the Finance Union. Let's have a look at traffic.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
Well, according to calculations by PwC Strategy and economists, the investment potential of the 5-year, $100 billion year plan by President Cyril Ramaphosa to receive that much with regards to investment will add around 338 billion rand to South Africa's GDP over the period of 2019 to 2024. That's 5 years. In addition, an estimated 825,000 direct and indirect jobs on average per year, that is, will be created or sustained and generate an estimated 59 billion rand in additional government revenue. Lulu Krachel, Chief Economist at PwC, joining us on the line now. Lulu, these numbers are astronomical and they're great, but only if they're applied correctly, am I right?
Good morning, Arabile. Absolutely. Yes, they do sound big, and they are quite significant. And I think the important thing for us with this research is to show that this is an important step in the beginning in getting the investment flows in South Africa going again. And hopefully this will send a message to other companies, specifically because these are large, in a lot of cases, large international firms, looking at investing more money in South Africa, that South Africa is the place to be at the moment and the place to invest, and that there are large corporates that's expecting to get return on their investments.
Surely then things can't get any worse than they currently are. It's only up from here. Is that the sentiment we should be having?
Well, personally, and also if we look at our own views of PwC as an economic team, we do believe that we have turned the corner in terms of the economy. Unfortunately, the road is not going to be a fast one upwards. There are a couple of steps that needs to be taken, but this is an important first step because we need investment-led growth. We don't need consumption-led growth. We know that the South African consumer is under pressure, and that is not a sustainable way to actually create more jobs. So one of the best ways to create more jobs in the economy is to actually expand in our production capacity. And this is what investment of this kind will do.
Having the right leadership and then a combined or one singular message is certainly going to help the situation as well, wouldn't it? To have a clear pathway for this is exactly what we're going to do. We're going to focus on these elements. And that's what we fix. And that even if you don't get the total buy-in of 100% of people, at least you get the job done, however, and you stand by your word. That's also going to be critical.
Absolutely. Something of something is better than something of nothing, as they say. And research that we've done prior to the investment summit also showed us that if you look at investment flows into South Africa and into other developing countries, policy certainty, sending the right message, being clear about the messaging is one of the most important factors. At the end of the day, what the policy is of course important as well, but government going out there and saying this is what we're going to do or this is going to be our approach Whatever the policy is in fact probably the most important factor.
We're a nation that certainly worries a lot about our credit rating. We, you know, the moment we know that the credit ratings agencies are set to perhaps give out their thoughts on South Africa, we really get hyperventilated, if you want to call it that. According to this, and if it does, according to your calculations, your analysis as well, if things do go in this manner, how soon do you think we can return to investment grade on all three of the ratings agencies?
Yes. I think the first step was that Minister Mweni, in his MTBPS, medium-term budget, he said we are going to really tighten up on government expenditure, because government debt, of course, is one of the major concerns for the credit rating agencies. So we know that government doesn't have bandwidth to spend more. And what the President and the DTI and the Presidential Committee that's working on this are doing is they're saying to private sector, we need you to get the economy going. We as government don't have the bandwidth. And if we can do that, if we can keep government credit or government debt, rather, under control, and we can grow the private sector concurrently, we at the end of the day will start to see tax income as well. As you mentioned in the intro, we did calculate that there could be significant revenue flowing to government from this, and we've seen company taxes over the last couple of years as a share of total tax take falling below personal income tax. So we'd rather want to turn that around and see companies through growth and not through higher tax levels actually contributing more to the fiscus. So if we can do this and if we look at National Treasury's projections, I think we can be at that point maybe in the next 2 to 3 years if things go well.
All right. Well, that is at least very hopeful. One might ask, though, is that are we drinking the Kool-Aid here? Are we just expecting that South Africa is going to maintain an investment stance? The world is going to just continue to invest in us despite where we currently sit? Because if growth continues to disappoint, surely that falls by the wayside.
That is true. There's two things that's important for investors. It's firstly the risk that they need to deal with, and secondly, the return that they can expect. If we have the policy certainty and we have the growth, then South Africa will be an attractive investment destination. Unfortunately, we know on both sides at the moment it's not a perfect picture, and there's some things that we need to work on. But on the positive side, if you look at what we have to offer in terms of our role in Africa still, the kind of infrastructure that we can provide, the financial markets, access to capital, all of those things, they do definitely still serve us in good stead, and we can use that as a springboard, and we should do that. And then the other factor that's important is, yes, these are pledges, but some of these companies have already started on these processes. I'm thinking about a company, local firm like Vodacom, that is already in the process of spending capital of expanding networks. So they were one of the companies that pledged investment there. Anglo is already busy with some of the initiatives that it announced. So not all of these initiatives that were announced are brand new and the processes need to start now. Companies are already doing it. And I think that is a very important positive signal to tell us that business do believe that we've turned the corner. And if they start believing that, then we would start to see some positive results. And that's why I don't believe that it's only talk. There are some of them that are already investing.
Lulu Krechel, appreciate your time there. Chief Economist at PwC, just that PwC strategy and economist analysis and communication there, coming through from their SA Investment Conference, where they also say that the investment into the country could enable 468.8 billion rand in potential production from 2025 to 2035. This production would, over the 10-year period, add an estimated 505 billion rand to South Africa's GDP and generate an estimated 133 billion rand in government revenue. That certainly would be some much needed money for the coffers. 7:30, your news headlines.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
7:31, Eskom's coal stockpile situation has deteriorated further, with five power stations having less than 10 days stock. Interventions to stabilize the coal supply may only have a positive impact by March next year. To talk to us about the story is Antoinette Slabbert, who is a journalist at MoneyWeb. Antoinette, thank you so much for your time this morning. Perhaps you can give us some perspective in terms of what exactly is happening with Eskom and the stockpiles.
Good morning, Natasha. Yes, Eskom has 15 coal-fired power stations, which is really the bulk of their generation capacity. Now, according to the grid code, which is the rules for Eskom and everybody who uses the grid, Eskom is required to have 20 days coal stock on their stockpiles at every power station. And the reason for that is that the power station eats coal all the time. It consumes coal day and night. For a power station to run, a coal-fired power station to run, you have to have a consistent a feed of coal into it. Now, if anything unforeseen happens, let's say the conveyor belt breaks or anything like that happens, you have to have coal on site that you can feed into it, and the rule then says 20 days stock that you have to have. Now, the problem is at the moment that those coal stocks are lower than that. As you said, even at five of the power stations, they have less than 10 days or less than 5 days stock available. And now the rainy season is approaching in Mpumalanga, where most of these power stations and the coal mines are. And if it starts to rain, those open pit mines can't produce coal. So, you know, if you then have something unforeseen happening and the coal isn't coming, then you are going to run out of coal and your power stations cannot run, which increases the risk of load shedding.
Then one might ask, how did Eskom find itself in this situation? Did they have some kind of bad relationship with coal suppliers?
It seems to be a number of factors. The first thing is that there was a lack of investment in the cost plus mines. Now, these mines are tied to a certain power station, and that is a very long-standing policy of Eskom. Eskom really assists the miner in investing into the mine, but in exchange for that, the mine delivers to Eskom mostly exclusively or otherwise first and foremost to Eskom. And that ensures that Eskom has a consistent supply of coal, even if the export price of coal skyrockets and it will be more lucrative for the miner to export, he is bound to the contract to supply Eskom first. Now, when Mr. Molefe came to Eskom, he said, we don't want a bakery, we just want a bread. And he diverted from that policy, saying we're doing away with cost-plus mines. In the meantime, Eskom has reverted back to the policy, but that has brought some instability in that space. And then there also seems to be a lack of proper management of these coal supply contracts. For example, we read the court papers in a dispute between Kuyasa Mining, who supplies Majuba, and Eskom. And from that it is clear that Kuyasa, that is not a cost plus mine, had an 8-year contract, was in a dispute with Eskom since 2013 about the escalation of the price that they are being paid. And Eskom just flip-flopped or they failed to address this issue until we came to a situation in October where Kuyasa just said, we're stepping away from this contract, we are not delivering coal at the price of 12.34 per gigajoule, which Eskom was paying them. So unless Eskom now pays them 27 rand per gigajoule, they are not supplying anymore. And I think that is the kind of thing that has happened with many of the suppliers, that there's a breakdown in negotiations and in relationships. And Eskom is finding itself without a proper supply of coal at the moment.
Does this increase the chance of possible load shedding sometime towards the end of the year?
It does, especially with the rainy season in Mpumalanga. And with Eskom saying it will only be able to stabilize the coal supply by March. So for us to get from where we are to March, there's quite a big risk of load shedding. And Eskom admits to that, you know. We are in a bit of trouble at the moment.
Antoinette, thank you so much for your time. That's Antoinette Slabbert, who's a journalist at MoneyWeb. We'll definitely keep touching base with her so we can find out what exactly is happening at Eskom. But Arabile, I've got a fun fact that is related to not Eskom per se, but electricity of somewhat.
Okay.
I found a way to make it work. So how lazy are you to warm up your food?
Quite.
I think Amazon can help you with that.
Okay, how?
They are now selling a $60 microwave that you can talk to through Amazon Alexa, but as long as you have an Amazon Echo speaker nearby, you are able to basically tell Alexa to warm up your food wherever you are in the house, and she'll be able to know for how long it's supposed to work for. So how it basically works is that you open the Alexa app on your iPhone or your Android device. You tap on devices and you add your microwave onto it, and then it sets it up and connects either automatically to Wi-Fi, and is also ready to set up with your Amazon, with your Amazon Fire TV product or Echo, and you can basically warm up your food, and she'll know exactly how long to warm it up for, because they've worked with food companies to basically know how long chicken is supposed to be warmed up for before it's ready, or your vegetables or whatever it is.
So 750 Rand essentially, plus minus.
Yeah, plus minus. But I've actually worked it out. So $60, that's about 864 Rand, with the Rand dollar being 14 Rand 40. And then you still need to get an Echo speaker, which costs you about $50. So that's 720 Rand. And then if you don't have Alexa, because you need her to help you out, that's $100. And that comes out to about 1,440. So the total for this laziness
is too much money.
It's about just over 3,000 Rand. And that doesn't include shipping, of course. But the part that is not so exciting, so it's kind of a tiny microwave. It's about 0.7 cubic feet, and I did the conversion to that, and that's about 19 liters, because microwaves are,
yeah. And that's very small, though.
It's very small. So there's certain things that can't warm up, like pizza. You can't put a whole pizza in there. You got to take the site, maybe take four slices in on a plate or something. And it only gets to about 700 watts of heating power, where an average microwave is about 34 liters, and you can get about 1,500 watts. But they're saying that they are working to either make it a little bit bigger and see if
one
they can.
One small step for man, one giant leap for laziness.
Exactly. So if you feel like you need a little help in the kitchen, Alexa's always nearby.
Oh boy, so many innovations, so many little tidbits that certainly begin to try and help us become even lazier than we were before. All right.
Someone who can help you is Peter, because he's standing by for traffic.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Arensa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Cappuccino with the CEO.
Well, this time around, cappuccino with the CEOs, with a gentleman who rose up the ranks for quite a very long time and eventually made it up to the CEO of Datacentrics. He spent at least a decade climbing up the ranks and trying to become the leader of this kind of this company, saying that he'd likes to impart his knowledge on other people, and it has been a great honor for him to serve as CEO as he continues to do so. He did just win Businessman of the Year as well, just not so long ago as well. So it's our cappuccino with the CEO, and this time around, he's Business Person of the Year, CEO of Datacentrics, Ahmed Mohammed. Ahmed, thank you so much for your time this morning. Really appreciate it. And having won that Minara Chamber of Commerce Business Awards, Business Person of the Year Award, that must have been a great honor.
Good morning. Yes, it certainly was. I jokingly said at the event that I've been nominated a few times and I've never won these awards, and it was pleasing to see that I did it on that occasion. It's been the case of always being the, whatever say, the bridesmaid, but never being the bride.
It seems to have followed the way of your career almost. You know, things have taken time. You've worked really hard to get to you know, even the top, which is CEO now of Datacentrix, and much the same with this award.
Yeah, it takes hard work to get to the positions that we are in. I mean, I started very early in my life during the early 80s, and it was difficult. But I was also actually very fortunate. In my early career, I was involved with an organization, joined earlier on in that business when it was very small. Then started as a trainee manager and got promoted to within months, basically, to branch manager, and eventually within a couple of years to operations manager, controlling about a third of the organization. In many respects, I've been fortunate in that sense. I've been operating at board level for almost 25, 30 years. So the title of CEO at Datacentrix just caps that.
Yeah. One question then, you know, people always ask, how do you get there? What is it exactly that you feel you do daily or did daily in order to get yourself to this position? And what is it you do right now to ensure that you're still the right kind of leadership and leader that Datacentrix needs?
Yeah, I think when you speak to most leaders in the country or globally, they'll tell you it takes a lot of hard work. But with that, there's a lot of people to support you. There's also some luck involved in it, you know. There's people put in the hard miles but never get to those type of positions. So I think it's a number of factors that contribute to it. In that process, you sacrifice your family. And one of the things that does happen is that, you know, you don't see your kids grow up. So there are sacrifices in that process, but it's your hard work, commitment, dedication, and I guess passion for what you do. If you have the passion for what you do, you tend to succeed a lot easier.
Yeah. What was perhaps your most significant turning point or a point in your career where you felt, you know, this has turned you out for the better, this has certainly helped you sort of pick things up, grow, turn your life around, so to speak?
I must say, I think it was very early in my career. As I said, I joined a large organization, a small organization at that stage. It's very large now. But when we set about doing this with a number of individuals in that organization, it was a handful of outlets we had. Eventually, when I left, I think it developed to over north of 100 outlets in that organization. But interestingly, we did very interesting stuff in that organization, what we term right now as BE. We did it in the late 80s, mid 80s. So it was a very interesting journey during that time. And for me, I think I've just been very lucky through that process. As I said, I rose through the ranks quite early on. I was exposed to some incredible people in my career and learned a lot in the early stages of my career. And I guess right now the challenges for not just myself, but I think there's two challenges, one for the company and the other for the country. And my passion right now is to try and create as many jobs as we can. I think we've got a huge lick. I mean, if you look at the current unemployment stats, it's north of 25-30%. So we've got a huge responsibility to create real jobs out there. Without doing that, we'll be heading for serious problems. So I think from a country point of view, there's a lot to be done. And we try and do our bit in terms of that. We've developed a number of people. We've got internship programs like many other organizations, learnership programs, and so on. And we do our bits in terms of enterprise development and so on. So the development of the culture of the country in terms of building IP out, building jobs, creating opportunities for others is critical. And that's really what drives me. I tend to balance my focus as a leader of organization between the shareholders and the people in the business. So in data centrics, we've created north of 1,000 jobs over the last couple of years.
Yeah, that, I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. But it's all the stress, all the strain of having to, you know, perhaps sometimes, you know, forego family time and focus a whole lot more on not just your company, but as you said, an economic mandate, which is to create the kind of jobs that the country needs. Is this what you wanted to do when you think back to your early childhood?
I think many people, if you speak to them, they'll tell you they stumble on things. And I think that happened to me when I got into this job in the early years, and it took one thing led to another. And as I said, I rose through the ranks very, very quickly. So I was in senior management literally within 5 years of starting out my career. But I mean, ingrained in me is business. My parents were always entrepreneurs. They got me involved in business at a very early stage. So I guess my grounding is always in management, developing businesses and so on.
Yeah, definitely an indelible mark being placed on you from that stage as well. If you were to then give advice to all those who are certainly keen on being part of, you know, not just the business community, but in growing and forging a way through an entity, even if it's not necessarily just through entrepreneurship, but, you know, through coming up in the likes of Datacentrics, what would your words be to them?
I think the first thing you need to start off is do something that you're passionate about. It comes a lot easier if you're passionate about a particular thing.
Mm.
You know, if you're doing something you don't like and it's a grind and it's a slog, it's a lot more difficult. So passion is critical. So in the field that you choose, make sure that you enjoy that field. Secondly, it takes a lot of hard work. Be focused, understand what you're trying to achieve and what you want, and you know, do it ethically. I think for me, that's a very important facet. I think too often in organizations you find these days that there's a lot of unethical behavior. And one of the reasons I haven't gone into big organizations is really that many large organizations have got a lot of politics in them, and you don't really drive strategy. Small organizations, you tend to set the strategy and implement that, and there's much less noise in those organizations. So I enjoy that. And if I've got to advise people, get involved, be passionate, and be committed to it. Learn everything about the field that you're going into. And every day is a learning curve. I've gone 57 years of my life, and every day I learn new things from different people. You never stop learning. You know, technology is changing fast. The field we're in is moving at the rates of knots and changing the landscape of the business environment significantly, and it has massive impacts.
Mm.
So,
yeah. I would be remiss if I didn't talk to you then about Datacentrics and the company as well. Where to from here? You know, the growth options for Datacentrics, what are those? Where are you looking to invest a lot more into? And, you know, you may not have necessarily made a pledge when it comes to the investment forum, but what is your pledge in a sense for South Africa, for the investment community locally to help grow the economy a whole lot more as well?
Well, as I said, my priority is in terms of creating jobs, and in order to do that, we have to grow the business. So we've created, as I mentioned earlier, over 1,000 jobs over the last couple of years, and that's organic. So we haven't acquired entities and put them together to create those jobs. Those are new jobs that we've created in the market. And my drive is to do that. Technology is moving quite fast. I don't think sometimes people realize that at the rate at which technology is moving. So investment areas are going to be in terms of the IP type of businesses, your AIs, your IoT sort of devices, and the new generation technologies in cloud and so on. So there's still massive growth area for us in those particular areas. Our challenge is to keep pace with that because it is, as I've mentioned, moving at the rate of knots.
Ahmed, I must now ask you probably the most important question here. Do you support any soccer teams, and if so, which one?
Yeah, I think in the early years I was a Man United supporter.
In the early years? Wait, what do you mean the early years?
Yeah, these days I think my kids support, I forget the name, but there's always a healthy rivalry in the house, so I sort of try and stay neutral. I get very little time to watch sports, and typically I've got grandkids, and whatever time I've got, I spend with them. But it does remind me of the 80s when we had clubs like Dynamos and so on in the environment.
Yes, locally,
used to support that locally. So, I mean, we've got some great talent in the field of, particularly in soccer and cricket in South Africa. So, if you see these youngsters going international, it's very pleasing to see that development and that opportunity being granted to them, which guys in the 80s didn't have, who are most probably as talented as the guys today, if not more.
You're a true patriot of this country. Really appreciate your time, Ahmed Mohammed, CEO of Datacentrics. They're really detailing not just the life of Datacentrics and how he got there, but also just how South Africa is a key focus for him, and the growth of unlocking and unpacking more potential for South Africa is hugely, hugely important and hugely significant for him too. So that was our cappuccino with the CEO.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Arensa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
South Africa is facing a savings crisis, and retiring well should be a priority for each and every one of us. Do not be a statistic, just one part of the population who is not planning ahead and saving for the future. Take charge of your retirement journey. Join MoneyWeb and Liberty for our one-day Retire Well Masterclass on Tuesday, the 20th of November, where investment experts will share their insights on a number of retirement subjects. The masterclass will take place at Summer Place in Sandton. The first five people to email MoneyWeb with the heading Classic 1027 Retire Well at events@moneyweb.co.za stand a chance to win a free ticket.
This is Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Arensa on Classic 1027.
7:55. I wonder whether one day Arabile will tell his kids, in the early days, I used to be a Man United supporter.
Look, in the early and latter days, I will still be a Man United supporter.
Chris, what will you be keeping an eye on today?
I think the oil price. You know, we were chatting about that earlier, and that is going to dictate, I think, a lot of what goes on. The other thing we've got to look at from an international perspective is what happens in the UK with Theresa May. She's really gone out on a limb with this whole Brexit thing. She really thinks she's got this thing nailed now, but I don't think she has. And she's having to rely on a very fragile alliance with the Democratic Unionists in the UK Parliament. And if she doesn't manage to get the head of that organisation, a woman called Arlene Foster, on board, then there could be all sorts of problems. So I think watch the pound. I mean, the pound strengthened a bit last night when we got the news that some sort of deal had been cobbled together. But as I say, I think this is fairly fragile. So I think the pound could be bouncing around all over the place. And any of the stocks on the Joburg market that are dual listed in London and Johannesburg are going to react to that.
All right. Arabile, this might not be a question that applies to you, but it might apply to Chris Gilmer. Chris Gilmer, would you be keen on trying a Tesla Kila?
depends what it is.
It sounds like a tequila that Elon Musk would serve.
You're close enough. So Tesla co-founder, obviously Elon Musk, and so Mexico's tequila producers are a little... let's just say, made uncomfortable by the fact that Elon Musk wants to launch his own tequila brand, and it's going to be dubbed the Tesla Kila. He tweeted it on October 12th, and so the producers are not quite happy. According to them, they believe that you should be using local producers. It should be made in certain Mexican states. And according to U.S. Patent and Trademark Office website, Tesla has filed an application to trademark Tesla Kila as a distilled agave liqueur. And similar applications have been filed in Mexico, the EU, and Jamaica. So you soon you'll be not only driving a Tesla, going to space one day, but you'll also be drinking one of these tequilas.
That's unbelievable. So, my gosh, what is it that he doesn't want to get into? And I know we talk about crazy ideas from him, but this has got to be one of his crazier ones.
But he's not the first celebrity. Doesn't George Clooney have a stake in a big...
Yeah.
I think so, actually. Yeah, but he's not just a business mogul, right? So
No, also true.
You know, yeah. he's an actor, so you kind of expect him to go into those sort of fields, whereas... With Elon Musk, you'd think that there'd be some business propriety there.
There is business propriety there. I mean, George Clooney sold his one for $1 billion. Bacardi bought Patron for $5.1 billion. And Jose Cuervo, the family, you know, launched an IPO in 2017, and they raised $900 million. So
are we saying that Elon Musk is going to sell the Tesla killer eventually to somebody else and they're going to buy it for billions of dollars as well?
Anything's possible.
It sadly is, isn't it? It is, sadly. So,
does anybody want to buy my special chutney, do you think? The famous branded Peter Terry chutney?
Depends what's in it, Peter.
Tesla killer.
Well, then it's going to go for more than just the Tesla, I can believe that. Quite a lot still happening around the board. Of course, the state capture inquiry continues. It's been absolutely riveting stuff, having heard Mzwanele Manyi come to testimony there. Pravin Gordhan has extended sort of his time when he will finally appear at the State Capture Commission. It is set for next week, so watch out for that also. And of course, yesterday we saw Naspers rallying 4.2% on the back of good news out of Tencent. Will that continue today? We will see. The market is obviously what we look out for. Goodbye, and we'll do this again tomorrow.
Bye.